Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Oh, hello. Welcome to another Rahalastapa. I'm here at the Lowry in Salford because we're on tour. I just wanted to show you the new Rahalastapa website. Look at this. It's amazing. If you're a member, if you become a badger for £3 a month, you can get all this amazing stuff. You get exclusive news. There isn't any at the moment. You get some of my stand-up shows, 3 every now and again. We'll put them all up. And look at all these backstage videos you get. Here it is. Look, there's another 5 minutes with Les Dennis. It's not bad, is it? And it's with everyone that we've had for ages. And there's loads more there. There's news. There's all my gigs. I'm on tour. Go to rahalastapa.co.uk or richardherring.com/gigs. I'm coming all over the place, as always. I didn't mean it like that. King's Place in London. I've got Russell Howard on the 10th and Michael Sheen on the 17th of June. Warwick Arts Centre on the 28th of June. Henley Festival, Canterbury on the 17th of June. Great Yorkshire Fringe on the 26th of July. And then the Edinburgh Festival from the 2nd to the 25th of August. And loads more. So check out the website for that. So go to rahalastapa.co.uk and you can get all these extras. News of all the who the guests are going to be first. There'll be emails coming to you and everything, and a monthly draw as well, £3 a month, and you can get all those extras. Anyway, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Rahalastapa with Matthew Lucas. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Leicester Square Theatre. Please welcome a man who, as we record this, has just been spending another whole day on Twitter talking to idiots about International Men's Day. It's Richard Herring! Hello, welcome to Richard Herring's Lemmy Sexes Tadpoles podcast. It's a we changed the direction a little bit this now. What it is now is that Lemmy from Motorhead, he comes in every week and he tells you what sex you give him any tadpole, he tells you what sex is. We're having difficulty contacting for it, but he's definitely gonna.
He's definitely going to do it. Though I was talking to a man I met who works in the castle and has one of those really big piercings in his earlobe. He calls it Rehelastupper. So it's a reference to last week's podcast. You're much better than last week's audience. So it's like March as we recorded this, and on March the 8th every year I go on Twitter and I find everyone who tweets when's International Men's Day, and I tell them it's November the 19th. It's a fucking pain in the ass. And now, unfortunately, I've started raising money for charity for it, and it keeps raising loads of money, and so I can't fucking stop it, can I? Until one of the cunts on there kills me, which is what is going to happen. It's getting scarier every year. Both directions, both the meninists and the feminists, they should get together, those lot, and form an army. They're both increasingly insane on both ends of the spectrum. But no, it's been fun. I raised £100,000 for Refuge in one day. £100,000. It's actually more than that. I don't say that to show off. I just realised that if I could do that every single day, I can make £36,500,000. So I'm not doing these podcasts anymore. What a waste of time. I'm just going to go, and I'll give like half. I'm happy to do it for one day for charity. I don't mind doing that. And then the rest of it will be for, maybe I'll give half the money to charity and the whole thing. That's a nice guy. I see no flaw with that plan. And in the news this week, as we were recording this, Trump met the head of Apple Computers and called him Tim Apple. What an idiot. Ian Apple, that's his name. Everyone knows that. So it's good to see Donald Trump using my material. Things have got desperate for Donald Trump. So look, hey. Let's crack straight on with this fantastic first. I mean, only guest this week. Nearly gave it away. I think I covered it. He's probably best known for being a crowd member in the Vindaloo video. Remember that Vindaloo with old Keith Allen? Remember him? He was also Sir Oswald in Plunkett and MacLean. Will you please welcome Matt Lucas, ladies and gentlemen? From Plunkett and MacLean. I'd love to see you. Come on in, sit down.
Plunkett and MacLean.
Yeah. I'd forgotten about Plunkett and MacLean until I looked you up on IMDb.
So had I.
Yeah. Do you remember much about working on Plunkett? That must have been one of your earliest film jobs.
I think it might have been the first film that I was in.
Wow.
Or the second film. It was me and David. What, you guys remember David Walliams?
No.
It was very exciting. It was directed by Ridley Scott's son, Jake Scott.
Okay.
I think he'd done the Everybody Hurts REM video.
Okay.
And there was Liv Tyler in it, so I got to meet Liv Tyler.
Nice.
Got to meet Robert Carlyle.
Yes. He was Plunkett or MacLean.
He was one of those two.
And Johnny Lee Miller.
Johnny Lee Miller was the MacLean other one, who I'd been in the youth National Youth Music Theatre with many years earlier. And my main memory of doing that film was that we played prisoners, aristocratic prisoners, and we were filming a scene at a banquet, and we were just filming the same scene again and again and again over the course of a week, a long scene, and just the same food was on the table getting more and more rotten and sort of gradually getting intoxicated by the fumes of rotten meat,
wow.
Pig's head and things like that, wow. Yeah. It's a lovely story.
It is nice. Nice to remember it. I'm glad to have brought that memory back. And what the Vindaloo video, you're in the crowd scene of the Vindaloo. We all love Vindaloo.
Yeah, in that video, Fat Les.
With
Keith Allen. What
would it take for you to flake the actor Keith Allen? It's one of my emergency questions, so...
Is that in the book?
Yeah.
That's not one of the ones... Who suggested that?
That was... it kind of came from Matthew Crosby on an Edinburgh Fringe podcast when he told a story about Keith Allen coming into somewhere like the Groucho Club. Yeah. And just shouting, "Who wants to suck my cock?" And then everyone just sort of looked at the floor a bit embarrassed.
Do you genuinely want an answer?
Yeah, I do.
It would take for me to no longer be alive.
It's a good question, good answer to the question. So I've been
no disrespect to Keith if you're listening.
So it gets a bit. We nearly had.
I used to work for Keith. Yeah, I used to work for Keith Allen. Me and David were writers on this TV show made by his company, so we'd go into Keith Allen's office and write every day. Yeah, Yeah.
Yeah, I've got quite a lot of personal beef with him in my... Well, I've been over it a lot in this time. He nearly came... One of his... Someone got in touch with me and said, would you like Keith Allen as a guest on the podcast? And I said, you know, there's a bit of history there.
What's the history?
He kind of came and wrecked our student show and was horrible to us in the 1980s.
Right.
And they said, yeah. And I kind of thought, maybe you're quite interesting to talk to him. And then I decided not. Yeah. I realised I didn't want to drag it all up, so instead I thought I'd get you on to drag it all up.
Thank you.
I've been listening to your fantastic book, Little Me.
Thank you, Little Me.
Yeah, and on audiobook, which is a great way to enjoy it, I have to say. It's very nice having you. It was weird when I came out of the toilet and you were standing there and I was listening to you narrate your book.
Yeah.
That was an odd experience.
But that actually happens to anyone who listens to it.
That's an amazing service you're providing.
Yeah. Well, it's weird. I wrote this autobiography and it came out a little while ago. And it's a little bit different to conventional autobiographies in that it's not chronological. It's an A to Z of my life. So like B is for baldness, G is for gay. And
yeah, I'm gay.
And things like that. So
although it comes out sort of... I mean, you do...
It's sort of chronological. It kind of ends up being roughly chronological, except that Shooting Stars, which is a show that I did in my, you know, when I was 21... Is nearer the end of the book.
Because of the S. That was because it begins with S.
No, W, I think it's one of the scores. Okay. George Dawes, I think.
Okay, yeah. Right. There's lots of things...
Someone hasn't read the whole book.
I haven't read the whole book. Obviously, I haven't finished it because I was listening to it as That's I came right. out of the toilet.
What was happening? What were you listening to at that moment?
I was listening to at that moment, and then I was so shocked by you. I'm up to about... P or something. No, I've got beyond. I'm on R or S. I should know it's not S because I think I'm on S. What's S for?
S is for.
I haven't got a
socking Keith Allen. If you. Been, I can't remember what S is at this moment.
I should test you on all of the letters.
Yeah.
We're going to do it all the way through. Well, look, I wanted to say, I'm surprised you've never done stand-up, because I think a lot of those...
I did do stand-up.
Well, you did not as yourself, though.
Oh, no, not as myself, but I did the comedy circuit. For 4.5 years, from 18 till nearly 23.
I've heard that bit of the book, don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. in character as Sir Bernard Chumley.
But I think you, as yourself, are great. The chapter about the F is for food.
Yes.
All right, and it starts, you think, oh, come on, Matt, you're not just going to list your favourite and least favourite foods. But it's so fucking funny, that chapter.
You.
And, like, just you getting angry about foods you like and don't like. Yeah. I think that's an Edinburgh show. Well, I think you could do that as an Edinburgh show.
Do you know, it's funny, because actually when I recorded the audiobook, I realised that that chapter about food is 50 minutes long. So it kind of is an Edinburgh show, isn't it? Yeah.
It's great. So you've got, you know, there's a great... You as a person are a very interesting, you know, what you've always... been behind characters, right? Mm. Nearly always.
Mostly.
I know
a little bit more in recent years. I've been a bit more as myself.
Would you come back? I was to ask Les Dennis this, just to come and do, because he's not ever gone to Edinburgh and done a show about himself. Would you come and do a? Would you do a stand-up show about yourself, or do you always?
There's a couple of things in my head. There's a stand-up show I want to do about myself, but I don't want to do it yet. Okay. Which is that I did this TV show called Pompidou, and it usually when I used to do shows with David, when we finished filming, they even before the show had been broadcast, the BBC would say, "Oh, we'll give you some money to start writing the next series. We'll commission you to write." The first two episodes of the next series. So you'd sort of... Because there would be this gap where the show had to be edited and then publicised and then broadcast, and they wanted to keep things moving. But I did Pompidou, and they tested this show, which is my favourite thing I've ever done, and it tested worse than any other show has ever tested. And so the BBC, understandably, did not... then come forward and say, "Oh, we'd like you to write another episode of this, just in case this is a hit and we want to, you know, be ahead of ourselves." So I found myself in this position of thinking, well, this show still could please enough people that they might want more, but it might not. But I don't want to start writing anything else. So I said to myself, right, I'm going to start writing a diary. And so for this 1 year, I wrote a diary, not for publication, but I ended up writing a 900-page diary of absolutely everything.
Right.
And so at some point in my life, I want to go back and look at that. It wasn't written for to be read, but it's some of it's funny, some of it's really sad, you know, because I had some bereavement in my life and things like that. But this really weird thing happened because I became a bit of a slave to writing this diary, and a couple of people said, "Oh, are you going to carry on writing the diary?" Because, you know, obviously find that you're really sort of, because it kind of ended up being a bit like therapy.
Yeah.
But I actually, the reason I didn't carry on doing it is because I actually, it turned me a bit quite sociopathic in that if I was out and like somebody said something, whereas normally I would have bit my tongue, I would be a lot more confrontational because I kept thinking, well, this will make good reading. So it turned me into like a kind of Piers Morgan where I became for this year of my life a sort of provocateur in social situations.
Right.
And so it's a weird diary that I haven't read back yet, but I know that as it goes on, I just become sort of mad. I became quite mad doing it. So at some point, and I think it's a little too soon right now, but at some point I want to revisit that diary and think and see if there's anything in it from a stand-up point of view.
Sounds like a kind of Danny Wallace No Man film, isn't it? If you're doing that, you're just being negative rather than positive.
It's a really weird thing that happened, and it can happen to you if you are. Yeah, it happens to public personas. I think it's happened a little bit to Piers Morgan, who I don't have a positive or negative attitude about. We share a love of Arsenal, you know, and I don't sort of. But I do think sometimes, you know, if you're in his position, you're there's an expectation for you to have an opinion on absolutely everything, and that's one of the things that slightly scares me about appearing as myself.
Yeah,
you know, whereas in character, I felt it could be a little bit more selective.
Yeah, I mean, being in a character obviously allows you to take liberties and I mean, you talk about this in the book as well, about how, you know, you can sort of get the laugh for the joke, but also people are then laughing at the character as well as the joke, so you're getting a double whammy. Really.
Jerry Sadowitz said that, didn't he? He said, "I can go on stage and say I hate Margaret Thatcher, and people are sort of nod in agreement, or I can go on stage and say Margaret Thatcher's probably one of the most brilliant, and may I say most beautiful women I've ever come across." And he said people will get it and then they'll laugh as well.
Yeah.
But for me, I started doing, I mean, I sort of did some child acting and stuff at 14, 15 in the West End and stuff like that. But I started doing stand-up when I was 18, and I wasn't out as gay to people or anything like that. And I'd had a slightly strange upbringing because I'd lost my hair when I was 6, and I'd had a few sort of tough things in my childhood, and I thought, what I don't want to do is stand on a stage and talk about that.
No.
And I thought it would have been very disingenuous to stand there with a pint and a cigarette and talk about my girlfriend, because that's kind of what people did in the stand-up club. So for me, playing a character actually felt a lot more honest.
Yes, yeah. And, you know, but it was also brave. I saw a similar time I was attempting to do... Well, I was vacillating between doing myself and trying to do a character, and I never kind of got it. I was sort of a foot in both camps, and I never kind of got it quite right. Whereas, you know, in that 90s style, there was a lot of men doing, you know, stand-up had become quite boring, I think. There was some really great stand-ups, but there was a lot of men doing quite laddish stuff about exactly what you're talking about. And so when you came out and did something like Chumley, it was a breath of fresh air, and it alienated some audiences.
Oh yeah, yeah.
What I like about this book is that you're very honest about talking about, A, you're you're not always super confident about stuff, but B, you write about your bad gigs as well as your good gigs.
Oh yeah, well, which there were many of those.
But a lot of people don't. I'm not mentioning no names, Peter Kay's books. Every gig he's ever done is brilliant. And that's
Peter,
not,
but Pete, but I've only ever seen Peter go down an absolute
Well, apparently
storm.
Maybe that's the case. I think maybe Peter has a better idea of how he's going than the audience.
Do you really? I think
in his stand-up, I've talked about this before, but in his book he writes about being in school, being in Wizard of Oz, and he's the Cowardly Lion. And he misses some rehearsals, so they said, when it gets to that bit, Peter, just sit down and let everyone else... That line isn't really in this song, sit down and let everyone else, let the munchkins and everyone else do their stuff. And then it got to that bit, and he thought, oh, it's boring sitting here. So he got up and started dancing around the stage and dancing up and down the aisles. And he's going, everyone thought it was hilarious. I don't think everyone thought that was hilarious. I think all the munchkins thought he was a fucking cunt.
So,
and he doesn't, in the book, gives no indication of that. Whereas your book, you're very honest about.
Yeah.
Maybe too honest, and maybe in the other way.
Well, I'll be honest that Peter's a friend of mine.
I know.
Yeah. I genuinely think he's the funniest man in the country. Like, absolutely, I think he's the most brilliant stand-up.
You need to talk to the people from that Wizard of Oz show. They're still furious.
Yeah, but had I been a munchkin, I might have been a sad munchkin.
I think comedians get through by being ultra calm. Stuart, when he'd do gigs, he'd always come and go, I was the best, I did the best, I was the best. And sometimes he wasn't. He often was, but sometimes he wasn't the best on the bill. But he had to believe that to carry on. And that's what I think. Some people have that kind of, that's how they get through being a comedian. And some, I think it's more fun to read about someone saying, I did this gig and died on my ass, or this is how this character developed. Because all that alter ego of Chumley, which then turned up in George Dawes and everything else, comes from dealing with hecklers, right?
And absolutely. And actually, because I did this very, very, very strange stand-up act, and it would basically either do really well or do really badly. And it was very unusual that the audience were just lukewarm in their response. They'd be passionately one way or the other. So, me and David, I'll tell you who he is later. David Walliams would do shows in Edinburgh. And at the first show that we did together in Edinburgh in 95, we were put on stage at midnight. And so you'd play to audiences. You play in a room that was very, very hot already, because it had five or six shows on with those lights on. So you'd sort of walk in and be hit by this kind of wall of heat. And audiences would be drunk. And actually, it was the Wildman rooms at the Assembly Room. So the audience were on your left, they were ahead of you, and on your right. And if somebody needed to go to the toilet, which sometimes people do that time of night when they've drunk a lot, they'd actually have to walk across the stage to get to the toilet, because the stage was just the floor of the room.
Yeah.
And so we developed this very, very aggressive style of comedy. And so what you saw later on, years later in Little Britain, was born out of that, you know, need to assert our dominance of the territory. Because when you do a show at midnight in Edinburgh Festival, it might have your name on the door, but it's not automatically your territory. No. You have to claim it, and you have to really guard it. You know, so people went up to go to the loo. Somebody go, can I go to the loo? I go, yeah, of course, go, that's fine. They go, are you sure? Well, yeah, go. And I go, why the fuck are you going to the toilet? You know, and then like not let them back in and come in. No, you can't come back. And we'd sort of play with them and do like a whole thing. And David in particular was incredible. He was really fearless with audience members, and he would just, I remember him sort of taking a drink out of someone's hand and drinking. I mean, things that you didn't do, you know, that you would be too scared to do. But we sort of had a real sense of bravado. And so I think actually that when we did get onto TV, we were probably a bit too, the volume was a bit too high. You know, we were a bit too sort of assertive and aggressive in our comedy, perhaps.
Yeah.
So it did take us quite a while to get onto terrestrial television, because I think they came and saw us, and some people liked us and some people didn't, but together we would make audiences laugh a lot. But I think people sort of said, they're good, but you can't really put that on TV.
Well, but you did get on TV quite early anyway, but
kind of cable TV, I mean, in terms of our own stuff, doing Paramount Comedy Channel and UK Play and stuff like that.
But what I like about, and I'd heard this story before, but in the book, you when you first saw Reeves and Mortimer, you obviously were going to work with quite a lot. You actually rang up Channel 4 to complain about the show.
Yeah.
Which, do you think that's ever happened, that someone has, any of the people who's ever rung up a TV channel to complain about a show being rubbish?
Yeah, I think
have ended up being in the show with essentially with those people. That's got to be quite unusual, right?
I think Meghan Markle complained about the royal wedding of Andrew and Fergie, and now she's Well, I got very confused because I was 16 or 15 when that was on, and I was very earnest. Sorry.
I just love you.
Well, I was very very pompous young man, like very earnest, very pompous. I was in the National Youth Music Theatre. I'd done a show in the West End. I was kindly donating my time to Channel 4 and giving them 25 minutes of my time to watch their comedy show. And here was this Vic Reeves, talking in this thick accent I could barely understand. And if you watch Vic Reeves bring it out, he keeps saying, oh, later on in the show, we've got this coming on and that coming, we've got a kebab coming on and playing a tambourine or whatever he's saying. And then I was like, right, where is it? And also, why are there no guests? Why isn't Kim Wilde coming to sing a song or something? What's going on? And I was just utterly confused. And so I called up Channel 4. I said, I don't know, what is this? Why are you putting this on? This is not acceptable. And then the next week, I watched it. I said, I'm going to watch this because this is never going to be on again. So I'm just going to watch this to see what it was again. Just to say that I saw it. And then the next week, I said, I think I get it. And by the end of the first series, I was such a fan that I sort of made friends at college because I liked it and they liked it.
Yeah.
And so I was so much of a fan that we actually, we bonded. I have friendships to this day that are inspired and based on a mutual love of Reeves and Mortimer.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think nearly everything that I like in comedy, I hated the first time I saw it. So if something's good, it takes you a little while to tune into the vibe of it, I think, and then you go, oh, okay, I get it now.
I think it's also sometimes, I don't know if you have this thing, but when somebody tells you, when something's already got an audience and you're sort of coming to it after everyone else, it's just slightly annoying. It's I don't know how to explain it. When someone says, you have to watch Fleabag, you're like, all right, I'll decide if Fleabag's good or not. Then you watch Fleabag. That's the best thing ever made. There's a slight resentment on being told. Yeah. I don't know if I put this in the book, but it's very dull. I just warn you in advance. But when I was sort of 15 and 16 and I was at school, there was a sort of guy that would sort of say, you have to listen to Pink Floyd. Lucas, you have to listen to Pink Floyd. You have to listen to Led Zeppelin. Just because I was listening to sort of gayer music than that, and I've always hated those bands just because bossy men told me I had to listen to them. Yeah. Can you identify with that?
Yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, I was always more interested in comedy than music. So, but yeah, if you've discovered something, if it's your thing, then you're much more. You're much more supportive of it, which is probably why Michael Jackson's, some people think he's innocent, it's probably why. But you met Bob Mortimer quite early on when you started gigging. He saw you gig quite early, didn't he?
Yeah, so I started doing stand-up, doing open spots, and I'd been doing for 5 weeks. 5 weeks I've been doing open spots for. With this terrible routine, and Bob Mortimer was in the audience, and he moved down nearer the front when I was on, and then we spoke afterwards, and I was the biggest fan of Reeves and Mortimer.
Yeah.
And I it was amazing, and then a couple of years later I was doing The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer with them, and then Shooting Stars 2.5 years after that. And I'd gone to university, and I was I said to Bob, because I took a year out from university to try doing stand-up comedy. And I also had a full-time job working for Chelsea Football Club in their shop, which was weird for me because I'm an Arsenal fanatic. So I used to wear an Arsenal top underneath my Chelsea shirt.
You say that it's like in the film The Eagle Has Landed, where the Nazis have to wear their Nazi uniform. Yeah. That's how they get discovered, though, Matt. That's because one of them falls in the water and gets caught up in a mill wheel, and his UK, his English army, the costume comes off. And they can see he's a Nazi underneath.
Well, that film...
Did that happen to you?
When's that film set?
During World War II.
Yeah, well, that was based on me in the early 90s. Working at Chelsea.
There could be a film, but... He's Arsenal. He's Arsenal.
But I ended up doing two TV series and doing stand-up comedy TV shows while I was at university still. And then I left early to... I did a show at the Edinburgh Festival with... David Walliams, that was his name, and then we did get offered a show on Paramount Comedy Channel off the back of our first Edinburgh show. Yeah, yeah.
It's very, I mean, I think in the 90s...
Lucky, I've been very lucky.
In the 90s, you know, that was, it was... It's still kind of possible now, but there's so many... You know, when we were doing shows in Edinburgh in the 90s, there were 30 or 40 or 50 shows, and they'd all get seen by people, and someone could come and say, hey, come and do this on the telly. And but now, you know, there's 1,000 shows, so I think it would be very difficult to make that same impact as quickly.
Well, not only that, but you know, we did this show on the Paramount Comedy Channel, which eventually became Comedy Central, and... which was directed by Edgar Wright, obviously went on to become one of the greatest British film directors, or just generally film directors there are. And not only were we given the opportunity to make that show, but people saw it, even though it was on Paramount, because terrestrial TV at that time was 4 channels, and then if you had some form of cable or Sky or satellite, whatever, you probably had another 15 or something. And so... all the comics that I would work with would get home late night, you know, spark up a joint, and 2 in the morning they'd be watching the stuff we did on Paramount.
Yeah.
Now, you can have a show on BBC One, BBC Two, and actually, you can walk out your house the next day after it's been on and nobody will stop you. Nobody will... because people are finding their stuff in all different places, aren't they? Not just television.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I think there was... You know, you ended up doing Little Britain on BBC Three, which I think, again, at the time, think, oh, no, we want to be on BBC Two. But actually, that was probably an advantage as well, wasn't it?
Yeah,
that
you
became the biggest show on BBC Three, whereas if you'd been put straight on BBC Two, it might not have had the same impact.
Yeah, I agree, because, before that, we did this show on UK Play, Rock Profile.
So good,
and
Rock
that
Profile.
Thank you. And that had been really popular, again, because they didn't have that much content to show, because it was a low budget channel, so they would just show our shows again and again and again, and the same thing happened with BBC Three. They didn't have that much to show, so they would show I feel like they would show EastEnders 2 hours before it was on BBC One or something like that. And then they would just show Little Britain, and they had a couple of other I feel like Mark Wootton maybe had a show, Dom Jolly, a few other people had shows. Three Non-Blondes, I think they did.
Yeah, I think that might be.
And there were a few shows, but BBC Three didn't actually have that much to show, so we were very lucky about that. So by the time it was a co-production between BBC Three and BBC Two, that first series of Little Britain. And by the time we were on BBC Two, we already had fans and we already had reviews. So then it meant that BBC Two pushed it in a way that they might not have done.
Yeah.
And then after one series on Two, then it moved to BBC One. Then it moved to BBC Naught. I am an idiot. I am an idiot.
You are an idiot, but that's... Again, I think that's... But you, in the book, you talk about you being an idiot, and you do some stories about yourself that, you know, aren't flattering.
In fact, chapter I is for idiots.
It is. Yeah. And so you tell stories about yourself, about you being, you know, a bit of a prima donna or being a bit pompous or whatever. But I like it, because, like, people don't usually do that. You know, you can look back at yourself and go, that's when I was an idiot. I think a lot of showbiz people especially can't look back and go, oh, I was an idiot. They just go, I was always brilliant. And so it's very endearing, I think. I'm very brave as well to talk about being an asshole in
you,
a hotel.
You do it, though. I mean, you've been an influence on me, to be candid.
Yeah.
Like that. I always think my favourite comedians that I go and see are not always the funniest. They're the most interesting ones.
All right.
No. That came out wrongly. That came out wrongly. I genuinely meant that. I mean it as a compliment. No, not just about being funny, but about being interesting as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sorry, I didn't mean it like that. I've genuinely been a fan of yours. We hired you to work on Little Britain.
You did.
Yeah.
Sorry, I wasn't very good.
No. You were great. But I remember coming to see. I saw a number of your shows, but I think it was Talking Cock.
Yeah.
And I went to see it. Was it at the Arts Theatre? Is that where it
was?
Yeah,
it was. Yeah.
Okay, so I went to see your show, and when I said in the room, because we'd had Mark Gatiss script edit our first series and Rob Brydon do our second series. And people never wanted to do it again. So we were on the lookout. And I said, look, I saw Richard Herring do Talking Cock. And I sat in this audience. And there was never a moment where somebody in the audience wasn't in hysterics. There were these just pockets of laughter throughout the room, just constantly. People there in hysterics, just getting that.
People
joke.
Just couldn't people agree just on that. Which bits were funny.
No. And I mean, you know. You have the show and you're very generous to people and you give them time and you're very kind to them. But the truth is, you are one of my favourite comedians. And when I say that, it's not just about being funny. You have never, ever, ever been dull in anything I've seen you do. You've always been interesting and honest. And I feel the same way about David Baddiel as well, which is he's very candid. And I think his show, My Family, Not the Sitcom,
yeah, it's amazing.
Is amazing. And your work is in this kind of vein of looking at your own flaws and learning from them and talking about it. And I love that work that you do.
Thank you. Well, but it works very well in
they'll cut that.
They work. I can't have anyone saying anything nice about it. It's not allowed. But that's what's endearing. It's important, I think, to be honest. And I think that's what makes this a really interesting book, is because I think you're real. You know, you look back at your life and you can spot the mistakes you made, where things were a bit weird. You've had a roller coaster of a life where you've had to deal with a lot of things. The early stuff about your childhood, you just think, oh my God, you know, you want to kind of go back and, you say it yourself about yourself. But as a reader or a listener, you go, oh, you just want to go back to that little kid and say, it's going to be okay.
It wasn't okay.
No.
And I'm still struggling with events from my past.
Of course.
Recent and distant, you know.
Well,
A process of getting through every day, and people think fame insulates you, but actually, when you get a day when you're just feeling, and then you look up and you're being filmed, it makes you feel even a bit more.
But
that's not me whinging. I'm very grateful, and I've been very lucky. But actually, anybody who thinks being famous will kind of cure any dissatisfaction you have with yourself or the events of your life, just be aware that. That hasn't been my experience.
No, I don't think it's anyone's experience. I think a lot of people think that I'll show everyone all this stuff went wrong. I'll show everyone I'll be famous and then everyone will love me. And it does. That's not how it works. But I think for you to be able to look back and be honest about it, and you're a very sensitive person. I've always known you're very sensitive. You take criticism.
I can't believe you say that.
And so
that is what I'm going to take away from this.
But, you know, losing your hair as a child, and that's a very, very difficult thing for a young child. And then as growing up, going through all your teenage years as that boy, the boy with no hair, that's kind of so difficult to get through. And obviously you get through it. I think you would have been a funny kid anyway. I honestly do. I don't think it's, you know, I think you can see all the way through. And when I did Headmaster's Son, I thought, oh, I've turned out like I have because of my dad being my headmaster. And I kind of realised I was like I am before I got anywhere near my dad being my headmaster.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think you were always going to be this cheeky, funny kid. But then you've got to deal with, you know, several issues. One of them is that, you know, everywhere you go, you can't escape it. The only way you can escape it is by putting on a terrible wig that everyone knows is a wig.
As a kid, you
mean? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I did do.
Yeah.
So that's such a hard thing to get through. So as an adult reading that, as a grown adult, you're looking, oh my God, this is so... Just that is so hard to get through. But, you know, the fact that you've got through that and the fact that you're still... I love your comedy is silly and funny and rude, you know, and it's not, you know, it's your comedy. It isn't about trying to make people think... No, I was just getting you back. It is, but it isn't, you know, the laughter is the important thing, you know, it's the moment of laughter, it's the silliness, it's the big, that bigness of it. And that kind of surreal... That's what I loved. Rock Profiles was the first thing of yours that I'd... It wasn't the first thing I'd seen. It was the first thing I went, wow, these guys are fucking amazing. Because it was... You. you know, because you'd invested so much and you were, it was sort of, when you talk about it, there's a little bit of Reza Mortimer in there.
In terms of,
you know, they're not impressions,
they're
sort of broader canvas things.
Yeah, yeah.
But nobody was doing anything like you were doing. And Reza Mortimer was much more surreal than Rock Profiles, which if you can catch it, I mean, it's on, I've got a video of it.
Really?
I can lend it round.
It is on DVD.
Yeah.
I very rarely watch the stuff I'm in anyway, but I certainly haven't watched any of that or Little Brit or anything since it was made. But so, I mean, it's probably quite hard to sit through now. But at the time, we would just churn them out, you know, and we would do 2 episodes in a day. So that's 30 minutes of original material every day. So it's a lot to learn, just lines, remembering the lines. But we just sort of churn them out. And so because of that, they have a slight sense of kind of disposable energy, and they have a kind of freedom, you know, in the way that I always thought Lee Francis has that great sense of freedom, because he does a lot of stuff. So it's just sort of, I'll do that and I'll do this, and some of this lands and some of this doesn't. And I think there was this kind of, we had that same spirit of, let's just try this, let's just try that. And so it's not precious. When we moved on to doing Little Britain in more kind of formal sketches, I think then we were a bit more kind of painstaking about the structure of the sketch, the beats, it was a much more sort of formal work. But there are definitely people who much prefer us in Rock Profile. It's much more anarchic.
I think so. I mean, you know, well,
it's loose, isn't it?
Yeah, it's loose. I think it's that thing of discovering it, and exactly what you're talking about, coming back late at night and seeing it and feeling you discovered it. But, you know, I think it probably, because I think with Little Britain, it really is of its time. Right?
Oh, yes.
I mean, in so many ways. But it really, at the time,
it was just bang,
it was perfect, it was on the nose. And it's sort of amazing to think that, like, in a decade and a half, people can be looking at that and going, oh, you know.
This is questionable. Yeah, it's very problematic.
It's amazing how quickly that can turn around. But at the time, nobody was really saying that. And at the time, it was embraced. I mean, more than embraced. It was just everywhere you went, everyone... universally almost, like from tabloids right through, wasn't it? It was everyone was quoting it.
The thing about, there's pictures of me, you know, sometimes people message me on Twitter and say, please explain this, or the very accusatory, which I completely understand and accept. It's pictures of me from Come Fly With Me, where I play a black character, and I suppose the thing is that the one thing I will say is it's not necessarily an apology or an explanation or anything, but it's a context, which is that sometimes, you know, when pictures go down, you know, when you see like Prince Harry dressed in a Nazi uniform, there's a sense that photograph was a bit illicit, that he wasn't really supposed to be doing that. It was a secret photo. Somebody shouldn't really have sent the photo. It was a private thing. But when we played characters of other races, when we played transvestites, when we played... did any of this work that people are reevaluating and finding, you know, very difficult to stomach? We didn't do it in secret. This was on prime time, mainstream television. And we went, you know, our scripts would go to the BBC and they would go through John Plowman. And I mean, you worked on Series 3, you know, they would go through all of these things. And, you know, we wrote that material, we played those characters, but we weren't asked the questions then that we would be asked now. Because when I was a little kid, I would see predominantly white people on television and they would often play black people. And then there was a moment after that, I felt, in the sort of the late 80s and 90s, where that didn't happen, where people said it's wrong to sort of make comedy out of the fact that you're a white person playing a black person. That is not acceptable for comedy. But when we were doing Little Britain and when we were doing Come Fly With Me, it felt like things had gone somewhere else again after that. Vic and Bob were doing Otis Redding and Marvin Gaye, black, on The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, and I don't remember ever thinking, oh, it's funny that they're playing black people. It was just, I remember thinking at the time, it's very charming and sweet that they're playing Otis Redding and Marvin Gaye as these sort of northern dockers.
Yeah.
You know, and that was very surreal. And when I saw Harry Enfield playing Nelson Mandela, probably in the last decade, again, I thought, well, Harry Enfield has a funny... I remember thinking, Harry Enfield has a funny take on Nelson Mandela. Why wouldn't he dress up like Nelson Mandela to do it? And I remember thinking, for us... And it seems a very naive thing to think in the modern day. But I remember thinking, you know, there was a greediness to Little Britain and a show-off. We were show-offs in that we just wanted to play as many characters as possible. So we play black, white, straight, gay, male, female, fat, thin, tall, short, whatever. But I remember thinking, I actually remember thinking this, which I don't think like this anymore. But I remember thinking when we were doing Come Fly With Me, thinking Britain is multicultural, that's a wonderful thing. We actually wouldn't be doing our job if we didn't reflect the multiculture.
Yeah.
Now, that's what I thought then. I don't think that anymore.
Sure.
I don't think that anymore. I believe I'm much more simpatico with kind of a contemporary reading of or a contemporary approach to doing things. So I would not play characters of other races now.
No.
But I can't change what we did.
No.
The only thing I can say is, because I do get asked about this a lot, the only thing I can say is that I definitely didn't ever do it with any ill intent, ever.
No.
I never, ever, ever thought, wouldn't it be funny if I play a person of this race? Now, sometimes in the execution of a character, there was a crudeness. And I think the main example I've talked about in the past is we had a character in series 3, I think, of Little Britain called Ting Tong, who was a Thai bride. And both David and I, it was a rare thing where both David and I, we used to go away, have a little break after a series of Little Britain and come up with some ideas and come back together. And we both had written down Thai bride.
Right.
Right? And we'd both written that down. And I think what happened, so it was like, oh, well, we have to do this. And I think what happened is sometimes when you're playing lots of characters, you're doing everything you can to define them. Sometimes you only end up defining them in how different they are to the other characters you're playing. Because you're playing so, you know, if you're doing 40, 50, 60 characters in a series or across three series, you've just got to think, I've got to pull something out of the bag that makes this different to the other things. But I think the other thing that happened with that character, I remember really thinking in retrospect, is that wearing the prosthetics, one can become so buried under prosthetics that when you go to give a performance, you're either really wooden or really hammy. And sometimes you really are you've got these prosthetics on and you're so scared of nothing being seen because you're buried underneath it, that you end up giving a very big, crude performance. And so when I look at that, I don't think there's any truth in that performance. And I regret. But in terms of the change of culture, you know, Little Britain, when it came out, and certainly my memory of it, is that this was a show that actually sort of was more likely to piss off right-wing people than left-wing people. Now it's a show that pisses off left-wing people more than right-wing people, which is, it's interesting because the show hasn't changed.
No.
The time has changed.
But that's what's, you know, that is, the, is it is, that it, that was acceptable 15 years ago.
I can say is it definitely was acceptable at the time. And I'll give you an example. David played the transvestite, the rubbish transvestite, that felt to us like a very assertive, queer, and positively queer thing to do, which is to go, we're playing transvestites, we're playing gay people in our show. You know, I was identifying publicly as gay, and I had grown up on a diet of, you know, Mr. Humphreys, where it was all entendre, and that was anarchic in itself and kind of progressive in itself, but we were in a time where characters would say, I'm gay. And actually, Emily Howard, the transvestite, like, what we now think of as people who are transgender in terms of putting in its kind of crudest, simplistic sense, somebody born in the body of one gender who feels strongly that they are born, that is not the correct gender for them and that they undergo surgery and change, mm-hmm. that we genuinely didn't have much of an understanding of that even 15 years ago in the culture. And even me and David, who considered ourselves quite progressive, I didn't really have much of an understanding. So now, I mean, I would never dream of doing that as a character. I would never want to do that as a character.
But I think we'd reached the point...
It wouldn't feel like it was my right to do it.
No, no. But it felt... Maybe it felt like a bit like we'd reached a point where we'd banished all that stuff and now it was actually okay to laugh at it on the other side with a sort of... With a wink, with a sense of...
Yeah, with a
wink. This is how things used to be, but we're all right on and we know what the joke is here.
Yeah,
So then another 15 years, it looks like that joke's gone. But, you know, but that's... You can't... I've had the same thing with someone. There was a review of my book, Talking Cock, which I wrote in 2002.
Yeah.
And someone says, this doesn't tackle... the gender issues, transgender issues at all. And you're going, God, fuck, if I'd written a chapter about that in 2002, I'd been an amazing visionary. This book is 15 years old, 16 years old.
It was invisible.
No one was talking about that then.
The transgender community were invisible.
Yeah.
Then. It wasn't intended to be a dismissal of anybody from any community.
No.
Honestly, we didn't know. We didn't know.
No, and that's through a lot of comedy again.
Yeah, I did not know. I didn't know. But I certainly wouldn't do it now.
No. And I think that's what's important. If you've learned and you've changed,
I think
you have to be allowed. This is a real. It's interesting having Les on the other week. Les Dennis, who went through there was the 70s to the 80s comedians. There was a big change, and all those 70 comedians went, "No, I should still be allowed to do jokes about black people moving next door to me. What's going on?" And those guys disappeared and never worked again because they couldn't accept that they'd made a mistake and things had changed and that what they're doing wasn't now acceptable. And I think we'll get that again now. But then in 15 years' time, who knows what people are going to look back at the crazy, fucked up world we live in.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because I wonder, it's interesting. I wonder how RuPaul's Drag Race will be viewed in 15 years' time. Will there be a sense that the gay male representation of femininity is... not positive in that. I don't know. I'm not saying it is. I'm not leveling that accusation. But you can't really.
Well, with comedy, you can't start thinking like that.
Yeah.
You can only do. Comedy's funny in the moment. If anything survives, that's kind of incredible. But yeah, you look at Python. You look at the Goodies. There's lots of things in there that are utterly unacceptable. And more in Python than you would think. There's lots of sexism. There's lots of homophobia. There's lots of race things that are now unacceptable. And but that the hearts of the Pythons were in the right place even when they were doing that stuff. And you say, okay, that was the time and we've moved away from that.
Yes, and that's the thing. It's not material I would do now. But I still got to work, if me and David were to do Little Britain again, we've still got to piss people off.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we're not doing our jobs.
But it was.
So we'll have to find something new.
It was pushing things, and but that was that was very much the noughties. It was this kind of let's push a fence, let's see where. And lots and lots of comedians were doing it in lots of different ways. Let's push the barriers back, see what we can get. Well, we are being a bit naughty. We know this is a bit naughty in some cases. And then, that's. But it's doing a job at the time that you can't look back.
Yes, and I think also I would say look, people had less of a voice then. There was less social media around. That was just the very beginnings of Some of the Corpses Are Amusing and all of that. Just little forums and IRC on the internet was also kind of starting up around then. But the tribalism of our time, what didn't seem to exist in the same way then. Britain in general didn't appear to have as the tense racial relations that it has right now. That's my reading of it.
Yes, well, I think, maybe not as overtly. Maybe it was there and we didn't know.
And we were in bubble and we didn't know about it, yeah.
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 But, things have fucked up, haven't they? So it's gone... It's not the worst.
But I would say if anyone's listening and they're offending, I'll happily discuss anything, individual cases. And I've had people on Twitter just be very upset. And I said, look, I'll meet with you. I'll have a cup of tea with you. Let's talk about it.
Well, that's nice.
Because I do want to learn. I do want to learn about it. And
I think with all these things, I think it's
grow
being able
and
to
evolve.
Have
and I'm genuinely sorry to anybody whose life was made worse than it might have been because of our work. I mean, that's terrible if that's the case. I've had people say, I'm trans, and people used to say. Or people used to say, oh, you're the only gay in the village. To us, it was meant to be such a celebration, And some people were labelled only gay in the village at school. And that's that, you know, something that was only meant to be created as entertainment shouldn't make young gay people sad.
No, but it was talking about being gay on primetime TV as well. Yeah, so there was lots of positive things. So I'm sure you would get as many people coming and saying, oh my goodness, that gave me the confidence to talk about this with my friends and whatever. So you're never going to please everyone. And I think the issue is it's got to be a conversation, right? And all these things, all these issues for ever really, but over the last decades or so, people are scared to talk about stuff. And that's why you're getting racism coming out again now in this big way, because people have been bottling it up rather than having the conversation racism isn't a hard thing to kind of dissuade people of, really, when you look at the facts and talk about it, because it's fucking stupid.
Yeah, yeah.
But if you tell people they just can't be racist and don't explain why they can't be racist to them, if they don't understand that, they bottle it up and then it comes out. With all these things, it's the same. And I think that's the problem with social media, is it doesn't feel like a conversation. It feels like people saying, you can't, both sides, you can't do this, you can't do this. And it just becomes intractable, you know, a battle. And actually, most of these things that we talk about them, and everyone's allowed to talk through their concerns, you'll sort it out much, much more easily. So it's fantastic if you're talking to people about it. And I'll ask you an emergency question.
Yeah, go on.
But it's interesting to talk about. Thank you for talking about that, Matt. It's very interesting.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I think this
was not funny for the last 20
this
minutes.
This is... I think you've got an answer to this, but I don't know what it is, because you mentioned it in your book, but I'm one of my...
We went to see Matt Lucas, he was so earnest. What are you earnest?
In your book, you mentioned this, but I don't think, unless it's in the last bit of the book. Have you ever seen a ghost,
yes.
Matt Lucas? Well, but you don't say what it is.
No
one's business if you've
ridiculous.
Seen a ghost.
I have seen a ghost, but I also don't believe in ghosts, so...
Okay.
Yeah. Weird, isn't it? Have you seen a ghost?
No, because they don't exist.
I mean... I 100% agree with you, but I've also seen one. So,
what form did your ghost take?
It was ectoplasm, and it was in France when I was 14.
Okay,
but like I also just—I
mean, I saw ectoplasm when I was 14.
Yeah,
a lot of it. Oh, coming dripping off the ceiling down to his...
It was green ectoplasm.
Yeah, that can happen
in a cheap hotel in France. But I also think people who believe in ghosts are fucking idiots, so it doesn't make any sense.
When we moved house, it felt like, and there was loads going wrong, and we were very tired, and it really felt like that we were hearing a crying baby in the house when our baby wasn't crying, and we both heard it, and our house used to be a hospital, and or like a doctor's surgery with like rooms.
So you've heard a ghost.
But, you know, it wasn't a ghost.
The worst guest you've ever had on this podcast?
Well, there's been some shockers. I only have people on I like. I think the
Keith Allen.
Keith Allen would have been weird. Stuart was, you know, we could talk about Double Axe if you want to get on Double Axe.
Stuart was
the second time Stuart was on here, and he'd had a couple of chandies, I would say.
Yeah.
And was just a little bit too Stuart Lee. there's been ones where I've kind of felt like I've fucked it. You know, you're having a laugh and then you fuck it up, or you push a joke too far. So there's ones that I only feel bad about myself usually. So mostly the guests, it's such an enjoy. This is such a fucking great thing to do for me. It's, you just get to, I mean, especially now, just in my house all week. And then I come out and meet, you know, that's Vicky Pollard off the telly. It's in Plunkett and McLean. It's nearly always just really, really good. Like, really good. And even the ones that aren't really good, like now, there's something... That was a joke, because I know... No, it was a joke.
Absolutely fine with
it. No, it's a joke.
Yeah.
This is a very good one. Let's talk about touring with Blur, like again in the you were on Blur's tour bus, and that's just in the book
at the week of the release of The Great Escape.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
right,
fucking hell, you're right in there. So they'd seen you. You've been in their video.
I am Britpop.
You've been in their video. You've been in a lot of videos. You've been in Vindaloo. You've been in Ben Folds, which I'm very jealous of.
Ben's my friend. I saw him last week. I went upstate to New York to see him. He bought a sort of department store and is turning it into a house.
Really?
Yeah.
Watch out, there'll be ghosts in there of mannequins.
Yeah.
So you were in the Country House video.
Yeah. Yeah, that was weird. It's an odd story because I don't have many sort of famous friends, or I'm quite sort of.
You just said you were with Ben Folds.
Yeah. I don't have many. I didn't say I didn't have any. I don't have many, like, famous friends, yeah. But there was, you know, I was working with... Because what I'm about to do is very name-droppy. That's why I preface it with that. But I was working with Vic and Bob, and they had, you know, they'd see me on stage, and they put me in their show, The Smell of Reeves and Mortimer, and we had a rehearsal for the show in late 1994, and after the rehearsal this afternoon, Jim and Bob, as it was called Jim, they took me, the three of us went for a drink at the Groucho Club in London, where lots of celebrities would go, and I had never been there before, and I'm not really much of a drinker, and I don't do drugs or anything like that, so I was quite kind of wide-eyed to the whole scene. And then this guy came over and said, "Oh, Jim, let me show you this film that I've made." And this guy was Damien Hirst. And I'd heard of Damien Hirst. He was obviously very famous at that time, 94. And he took us up to a little room where Damien Hirst and Keith Allen were sat.
Oh, my goodness.
And they showed us a sort of two-minute-long film that Damien had made. And I think Damien had been at art school with Jim. Or something like
Probably.
This. They knew each other. And then... bless you. And then... A few months later, Damien said to Jim, "Who's that bald bloke you work with? I want to put him in a video I'm directing with Keith for Blur, for Country House." And Jim gave them my phone number, and this lady, Naira Park, called up, who then is now a big film producer, and mm-hmm. she was married to Keith, she wasn't yet married to Keith, but she went on to marry Keith. Then I turned up, and then there was a little bit of confusion because they had meant Les from Vic Reeves' Big Night Out. And they got me. I wasn't the droid they were looking for. But I was hired, I was there. And so we filmed this Country House video, and it was a sort of homage to Benny Hill of me being chased by lots of sort of Page Three style girls. Joe Guest was one of them, who was a sort of icon of of that sort of loaded lads era. And I went to film this video with Blur, and a couple of weeks earlier, I'd been on this TV show called The Beat. Do you remember The Beat with Gary Crowley?
Yes.
And I'd been reviewing music videos with Malcolm McLaren and Francoise Hardy. Right, and because I was doing Suburban, and I was on there as Sir Bernard Chumley, this character I used to do on the circuit. And my thing was, to the absolute puzzlement and bemusement of Malcolm McLaren and Francoise Hardy, that every time we watched a video, I would just say the same things. And I would just go, "I mean, it was so sassy. It was just so sassy." And I just kept going on and on about sassy. So when I turned up to they were just baffled. But Gary Crowley seemed to enjoy it. And so when I turned up to the filming of the Country House video, Alex James, the bass player, and maybe Dave Rowntree, the drummer, recognised me as, "Oh, sassy." And so they kind of took a shine to me. And we just had a fun day. But my main memory, if you watch the Country House video, is of me running, being chased, was I just had a terrible asthma attack. Because I have asthma, and just having to run and just being in a terrible state. And also recording on this sound stage at Three Mills in Bow, where there were loads of farm animals and they'd been shitting everywhere. So we're just in this kind of stinking, boiling hot room having an asthma attack. So
chased by Page Three girls.
Yeah, so I genuinely, every time I hear Country House, I'm kind of triggered. But we had a laugh, and then I went off to the Edinburgh Festival to do a show with David Walliams. And then someone got in touch with my management and said, "Oh, Blur are doing a tour as a warm-up tour before they do their big arena tour. They're doing a warm-up tour of eight. They're going for 9 days, and they're doing eight different seaside venues, sort of Clapton and Margate and all these places. And they would like a stand-up comedian to open for them. And so our show had just been filmed for Edinburgh Nights or something like that.
Yeah.
So I sent them a video of the show, and they said, great, we'll, you know, we'd like you to do it. And but, you know, you'll have to travel on your own. That's what support acts do. And do all it. And I went, I can't drive. I've got no one to take me around the country. Can I come on the tour bus? And they said, okay. And I said, can you give me some money as well, please? So, because I don't, you know, I've got bills. But I still lived at home, but I wanted some money.
Yes.
So I...
That's not unreasonable.
Not unreasonable.
No.
I was only 21. So they paid me £100 a night.
Right.
But the thing I remember was that they had caterers on tour and I wasn't allowed to eat
the
food. It's quite sad. I made up for it, obviously. And so I toured with Blur. Now, you have to understand that Blur at that time were... It was the Blur-Oasis wars. And Blur were actually bigger than Oasis still at that time. I know Oasis sort of flipped it, didn't they? And
yeah.
became the kind of winners, ultimately.
Yeah, I guess.
In a way. But at that time, Blur were number one. And the newspapers, the tabloids in particular, every day was Blur-Oasis, and you know... Noel versus Damon versus Liam versus, you know, and then slagging off Brett from Suede or Justine from Elastica. It was all that time. And it was an amazing thing to be on that bus and see it, and for them to be getting phone calls, oh, the Sun want to know this and that, and girls chasing the bus and everything like that. But my act wasn't very good yet and it wasn't very developed, and I would get booed off.
Yeah,
before the shows, and it's the only time in my entire career that I've ever got down on my knees and prayed before a gig, because I was getting booed off and booed off and booed off. But I remember doing one thing which was quite odd, which was we're in Dunoon in Scotland, and we were the last band to play in Dunoon was The Tourists, which was Annie Lennox and
Dave Stewart,
15 years earlier, I think in like 1979 or something like that. And there we were in 95. They were the biggest band in the country. They were playing the school hall. After 2 minutes, I'd been booed off with "You fat bastard, you fat bastard." Fair enough. And only one of those things isn't true. And but I remember that they had frosted glass windows in the dressing room. And I remember walking towards the window and the crowds all screaming because I had a brown wig as Sir Bernard Chumley. And then I would take the wig off. And I remember thinking, people out there think Damon Albarn wears a wig. Because I would walk up there and they'd be going, Damon! And then I'd take the wig off. But it was an amazing experience. And, you know, but it did signal the end of me doing stand-up. Definitely.
Really?
Yeah, definitely.
That's such an impossible... If you're the best stand-up in the world, to go and support a band is a terrible idea.
Yeah, terrible.
But also, you know, people want to see the band.
They want to see the band. They didn't want to see me. I think I had, like, three really good gigs, actually.
Yeah.
But I had some, you know, terrible responses and things thrown at me. I mean, the famous story is Tommy Cooper supporting the Police or Sting, and Tommy Cooper getting booed off at somewhere like Wembley Stadium or Milton Keynes. And then as he walks past Sting... going, follow that. whether that's true or not, but it was like that. I mean, I was absolutely roasted. And then it did start to kind of get to me, like, your confidence goes if you have a sequence of bad gigs. And I'd had a very bad gig at the Edinburgh Festival, which I talk about in the book, getting booed off in front of thousands of people at the Edinburgh Playhouse at 2:30 in the morning. And it did start to... But you know what? That meant that I did less gigs, fewer gigs, and started spending more time writing with my friend David.
Yes.
And one thing led to another. So it was good in a way to stop doing stand up, because the one thing I noticed when you do stand up is, do you remember, did you do the circuit?
I did for a couple of years, but I hated it. Yeah.
Right. So this is just this one thing, right? Just circuit comedians are amazing, and I have full respect for them. But there was this thing, and I don't know if it's still the same way, where you'd go into the dressing room before a gig, and somebody would go, I'm trying a new joke out tonight. And it would be the talk of everybody that they were trying the new joke out. And they would tell the joke and everybody would weigh in with, oh, maybe you should restructure it. And then we'd all listen to hear how the joke went. And you were not encouraged by promoters to change your set.
No.
And the thing was with David was that we were writing half an hour, 40 minutes of stuff that we used every week.
Yeah.
And you must have found that with Stuart as
Yeah, I think that's where we were unusual. When we're starting off, and Stu was very into stand-up, but I wasn't into stand-up, and I wanted to do sketches, and I wanted to do...
Yeah.
And, you know, I tried to do stand-up in those early... When I came back to it, I really liked it, but that took a long time for me to get to there. And because of all this Keith Allen experience as well, I had a big sort of... I felt that all the circuit kind of hated me personally because of this.
You hate him more than Patrick Marber?
Yeah, I kind of like Patrick now. But, you know, we never really hated Patrick. Patrick,
another podcast, well, another day.
You know, you sort of... everyone was Patrick Marber in the end, you realise.
Yes.
It was just... everyone was ambitious, you know, and he was just the most obviously ambitious early on, but...
Yeah.
It's worse to be the sneakily ambitious person, which he wasn't. Where was I?
We were able to be much more prolific.
So all those, we'd go and do those gigs. Everyone was literally, had been doing the same 20 minutes for 5 or 6 years. We would go...
Promoters would say to me, just to defend comedians, promoters would say, if I did a good gig, promoters would say to me afterwards, don't change your set.
Yeah.
Come back and do the same set next time. So I'm not comedians. The culture was not to write new stuff.
And it was easy. There were a lot of people going into stand-up because they wanted to have an easy life where they worked for 40 minutes, 50 minutes a night and got drunk at work and then had the day off. And so we were going in, as you were, I think, and we were meeting up when Stu got in about midday. And we were writing new stuff. We were writing hundreds of radio shows. We were writing hours and hours of radio stuff. We were writing new stuff for Edinburgh. We were writing stuff, you know, just for ourselves. We were writing scripts, and most people weren't doing that. And that's why, you know, so the stand-ups again resented me a little bit in that early stage because I was getting on the radio and I hadn't earned my spurs on the stand-up circuit, but I'd been out really working for 5 years, writing, which we did that whole decade, really.
But there was one marvel, who was Mark Thomas.
Yes.
Who was the king of the circuit and would do new material all the time.
Yeah.
And I still think he's one of the absolute greats.
Well, he's a mate, and he keeps on coming up with new ideas and new stuff all the time. But that's, if you want to have a career and if you want to expand yourself as a performer, you have to keep on trying new stuff out and doing weird stuff and it became, you know, I understood it. People were making, in those days, you could make great money as a stand-up. If you did the Comedy Store and Jongleurs, you could do 4 gigs on a Friday and Saturday, 6 gigs sometimes, and be making, you know, 50, 60, 70,000 pounds a year just from those weekends, which is not the case now because there's a lot more stand-ups and they're getting paid the same as they got paid in 1990. So it's become a much more more thankless task or a less thankless task.
I find the words more and less are interchangeable.
Yeah, they are. Either way. But yeah, so it's, you know, I think that's it. If you had that, to succeed, the people who succeed, and not everyone will succeed, you're saying there's talent, luck, and hard work.
Those are the three things
you need. You could still have all of those and not succeed, but if you don't, I think hard work is the thing that's really, that you've got to, the people I've seen who've been successful, because it's so competitive, they've just, you've got to be obsessive and it's got to be your life, which in your 20s and 30s is a bit easier. As you get a bit older, it's a bit like, oh, I'd like to have a bit of a life beyond that.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's the thing you realise as well, I think, as you get older, that the things you were striving for, that A, you're not going to become happy if you're friends with Robbie Williams or whoever necessarily.
You've read the book.
But, you know, whoever, you know, you're not, it's not going to make you happy to be accepted in itself in amongst other famous people. That is, it's a sort of meaningless thing. You can understand why it happens. You'll find happiness by examining yourself and by becoming, you know, by facing up to the things that made you who you are, you know. And you're a very nice person who's had to go who's had to go through some awful stuff, which, you know, I haven't had to do, you know.
Yeah, but lots of people, I don't have any monopoly on suffering. I mean, lots of people have their shit to deal with. But
yeah.
I hope I'm more humble now than I was when I was 18, 19 on the circuit.
We all. I mean, you know, you're very honest about then being a kid and, you know, going to the... You get to it. I mean, I remember that, you know. I remember getting my first radio... Tom was going to be in a radio show and I was on the tube reading the script on the tube thinking people were looking at me going, oh, that guy's got a... Hey, that looks like a radio script. That guy must be on the radio.
Is he?
Is he off to the drill hall?
And so, you know, you are, you know, you will behave like an arsehole, and you become successful and you will behave like an arsehole. Mm. It's just, you know, that's part of it. I think you're allowed 18 months or so of it, and then if you carry on, then, you know, it's not going to be good for you. You might still, for one, you know, you might still survive as a in the business, but you just, you're, something inside you will go, I think. And, you know, it's different when you've been in something like, I sort of am thankful, I often say this, I'm kind of thankful that This Morning Richard Not Judy, I think it could have gone, I don't think it would have ever become Little Britain-style success, but it was just getting to the point where it could have gone over that hill, and neither of us would have coped well with what you then, you know, what you then had to go through as super famous comedians. You know, it would have driven both of us mad in different ways, so I'm kind of glad it didn't happen to us then. But then it's sort of hard to cope with something being massively successful and then having to cope with the aftermath of, you know, as a double act breaks up and you know,
who says we're broken up?
I might be talking about myself.
Yeah.
Then, you know, then people judge you by each other's careers. So you know, you and I know this, that people will want to go, oh, isn't he doing better than you, or is he doing better than you? And they're not. It's not a balanced appraisal ever, you know. And so David's doing stuff that I don't think you would ever want to necessarily do. Maybe the,
I think,
writers,
David's doing stuff I wouldn't know how to do. I mean, David's amazing and brilliant. We are in contact, despite what people say. I emailed him yesterday. He emailed me today. It's fine. But
cunt, fuck off, you cunt. Fuck off. No, you fuck off. That's what me and Stu have been.
You look older now than you did when you looked young. To little insults like that. No, very cordial. But, oh, God, I forgot what I was going to say now.
But it's, you know, what was I saying? But it's, I think the thing that...
What I was saying was, he's absolutely brilliant. You know, that's it. I'm not going to say he's brilliant at what he does. He's brilliant. He's a brilliant man. He's the greatest, most talented person I've ever worked with. It's no surprise to me that he's the top-selling author, you know, and all of his other endeavours, very popular, and I'm pleased for him, and I also don't judge what I do by anyone else's career.
No, but other
I don't
people,
judge
other
any... Well, that, you can't control what other people do or say, and nor should you try to. I'm not going to list my credits to make any point.
No. But I was about to.
Oh, yeah.
But no, you.
But no, but I
you in America,
I don't look at him and cover, because I couldn't do what he does. I couldn't write those books. He's written those books. It's not like anybody could do that, but he's the one that did it.
Yeah.
That's a very naive way to look at it. So I don't look at it like that. I look at, my God, you know, look at the hard work he's put in, and look at the skill he's got and the talent he's got, and he deserves all the credit he gets.
Stuart doesn't.
But I do believe that, and I don't have a problem saying that.
No.
People will assume that you sort of, I don't.
Well, people want double acts to be, you know, they want them to break up and be angry, and you know that. So the story's self.
Well, I think there was some of that. Yeah. But it's not, you know, that stuff does dissipate over time. Yeah. You know, definitely, and so I don't think there's any issues.
No. But you've been in America, and you're living in America now, really, most of the time.
Yeah, back and forth. I'm here a bit more this year, because I'm going into Les Miserables again.
Oh, yes, of course, yeah. Brilliant.
Do you like the musicals?
I don't really like the musicals.
I like the musicals.
No. I'm a heterosexual man.
Right. There are Michael Balls in Les Mis.
Okay, I'll give it a go. No,
Alfie Beau, they're heterosexual men.
My goodness.
You don't like watching any musicals?
I like Tim Minchin stuff.
Yeah,
I do. I don't.
David Baddiel likes musicals.
Yeah,
we once had a night at David Baddiel's house watching both Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell.
Wow.
David said in quite a niche joke that nobody will get, this is Jews for Jesus musicals night. David likes his musicals.
Yeah.
Very into that. Have you seen Wicked?
No.
Right. So you can't judge.
No, I haven't seen them, I just...
I have, and I don't like it.
Okay.
No, I do like it, it's all right. Do you find yourself doing that, by the way, like in modern times, you're so worried about offending people to go, you make a joke and you go, I'm only joking. Do you find yourself doing
that? I try not to, but yeah, I understand. Right. Yeah, it is. It's difficult. People are... It's sort of an odd thing where comedy... I guess in the past, you would do a joke and it would go to the people who got it, or, you know, the people who didn't like it wouldn't seek it out, you know. But it's a sort of weird thing where you're worrying that much. It's a shame if we can't laugh at things, you know, or you're told you can't make jokes about a certain subject. I think that's a shame. But
I do agree with that thing that no subject is taboo. You just got to figure out how to do it in the right way and aim at the right targets.
Yeah,
all of that.
And you know, it's all about timing. Well, we're going to have to wrap up quite soon, which is
a shame. Thought we were going to talk about musicals.
Well, I wanted to talk about Community, being on Community, which is funny because you're also on. You played sort of Doctor Who fan on.
Yeah, I was in the series of Community that Dan Harmon didn't work.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah, I was going to say
the kind of bastard series.
Yeah,
but that was. Great. I mean, I got to work with Donald Glover and that amazing cast, Joel McHale and Danny Pudi, the great, you know, Alison Brie and all the brilliant cast of that show. And then it sort of bounced back because I ended up doing Doctor Who and sort of playing the real version of...
Yeah.
Playing in the real Inspector Space Time, yeah.
Yeah. And you presumably you're doing all the Comic Cons and the...
I've done two...
Yeah,
I've done two, and I think for me it's, you know, because some people do them every weekend, and I think that's not for me. But if I could do, I'd probably be happy to do one a year or something, and then really throw myself into it and enjoy it. I don't think I would want to do them every, because some people really do them. They sort of don't act anymore, they just do those.
Yeah.
And it gives them a very good living. But I really, really enjoy it in addition to the creative side of working.
Yeah.
But not as a substitute.
But people who like Doctor Who are nuts, right? So they're all correct.
No.
You wouldn't want to be in a room with people
like
that.
They're smart. They're smart. I actually say, like, it was a really interesting thing doing that show, because I did, the character I played was launched in a Christmas special, and in the Christmas specials you're encouraged to do things I was definitely encouraged to be very broad in my performance, which is not something I usually need any encouragement for anyway, if you've seen my recent turn in the film Polar. But, then they brought my character back, and he sort of became a little more earthed as he went on, and the community... of Doctor Who fans were very kind, you know, towards me. I can understand why you might not want somebody who you've already seen in a lot of other things to turn up in your show, because it's harder for them to believe that I am the character, because they just think, oh, that's that idiot who plays Vicky Pollard. But the great thing about doing the conventions, and it's why I don't want to do them every week, because I don't want to get cynical about them. It's why I want to keep it as a kind of special thing, is meeting the people who watch Doctor Who, because they are a very sort of intelligent bunch, and I love hearing their theories about the show, and I learn a lot about the show from them, because the main reason I did Doctor Who, in truth, was because my late partner was a huge Doctor Who fan, and so it was part of grieving, I guess, to go into that show, so it meant a slightly different thing to me. But it was amazing to work with Peter Capaldi and Pearl Mackie, and I'm writing a thing at the moment that's in development at the BBC, which Stephen Moffat and Brian Minchin will produce if it gets made. Fantastic. And I met them, obviously got to know them through Doctor Who. Yeah. They cast me in the show. So the thing I'm writing is this huge, big, epic fantasy thing, which is a complete departure from my other work. So I still feel like I'm part of the Doctor Who family. That's a great thing, to be part of that show. And also a significant percentage of the Doctor Who fan base are people with things like Asperger's and autism and parts of the spectrum. And Doctor Who speaks to them in a way that other shows don't. And I think there'll be many different theories and reasons why. So it's really interesting sometimes to meet people who watch that show who might ordinarily be shy or have difficulty talking to you, but because you're in that show, they're able to come up and talk to you. So that's the really rewarding, meaningful thing about doing the conventions. So the last convention I did was a dedicated Doctor Who convention called Gallifrey One, right. Which was... I absolutely loved it. Loved it. Have you done any conventions?
It's a kid show.
Yeah, it's a kid show. Have you done any conventions?
No. We were in an audio doctor.
Were you in at what? A Big Finish?
We were in a Big Finish.
You could do a convention now. You could do a convention.
I've done a signing and it was actually exactly the same thing as you're saying. Earlier on, when I said that thing about Doctor Who, I was just joking. Do you think? No, we did a signing, and it was what I loved. Like in about 2003, in like a kind of shop somewhere.
What of the Big Finish?
Yeah, just of the CD when it came.
Were we? What you and Stuart together were in it? Yeah, oh,
yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, and
I've done Big Finish.
Yeah, and it was just, and what I loved about it was that those people just loved the people coming, loved the thing.
Yeah.
Without any consciousness of like, you know, is this cool to like it? Is it not? Because they didn't care. They just fucking loved it. And you sort of think, all these people who are trying to do something to look a certain way, and these people are just coming to something that they adore.
Yeah.
And have all this, you know, all this stuff going back decades and signatures and autographs of all the... There was someone with like a cigarette cardboard that he got everyone to sign, and then it got so many signatures, there were like four or five frames, every frame then had a new frame around.
Yeah, yeah.
So that he was getting every... I mean, it's insane, because to get everyone's... autograph who's ever been in anything to do with Doctor Who is quite a difficult task.
But it's a great challenge.
But it's manageable.
Yeah, it's a great manageable. Challenge. Yeah. I honestly have met some really great people from that, and it's been very humbling and a great honour to be part of that show, actually, genuinely. Look at that, no cynicism from me. Unlike you, very cynical creature.
Disappointing. Some of these are the.
Are there any Whovians?
The more outgoing Who Doctor Who. It's all Doctor Who. They're all of them Doctor Who.
I'm not doing autographs after. Okay, understand. Seriously, I'm not doing it. No selfies. Nothing. Sorry, which door?
Oh dear.
There is only one door. I think you can only go through that door. I'll see you later for a selfie. No problem.
It's all right, Matt. There's a way out the back.
No problem. No, it's fine. It's fine. Honestly, it's fine. It's something that stays with you. And James Corden told me that that's what he gets the most fan mail from, is the fact that he was in Doctor Who. Yeah. And he's a big star.
Hey, look, there was loads more I wanted to talk to you about, but I can't... Oh, my goodness.
Was there anything you want to do really quickly?
What's it like being gay? No, it's... I'm thinking of switching over.
Really?
Yeah. It's really hard.
Let's do like a Freaky Friday. Okay, spot.
Right. I'd like to see a Freaky Friday film where they change bodies and they both prefer the other body, they prefer the other life and decide to stay in it. Or one of them does and the other one doesn't, but the other one stays.
Yeah.
It'd be good.
Yeah.
It shouldn't always be, I've learned that both our lives are difficult in different ways. No, it's much better being Lucas the missionary. I'm not changing back.
Have you had no gay experiences?
Not really. I've kissed some men. Stuart Lee tried to wank me with a ventriloquist puppet.
You had a slow dance with David Walliams at the Regency.
I told
room.
You, so I had a slow dance with David Walliams. But, I mean, he's straight, right? So that's not... If we're both straight...
You'll have to get him on the podcast to talk to him.
It was very nice because he's very tall. I did like it.
Very tall.
And I'm quite small.
Yeah.
And it was just lovely.
Felt safe in his arms,
didn't you? It was lovely. And I kissed a boy at the Edinburgh Fringe.
Did you?
Yeah.
What, ironically or actually?
I mean, you know, ironically with tongues for quite a while.
What? When? In the show?
At the end of like that, when we were trashing, taking the theatre down at the end of the festival, we had a sort of snog in the bleachers.
Was he gay?
I think he was bisexual. I was 100% straight, so that was fine.
Just proving to yourself.
But you write in the book about shaking stick. You've been shaking.
I write about changing the subject. Yeah. Is that what I write about?
No, because this is the same. This is the same. The first person you fancied felt funny about was Shaken Stevens.
Yeah, tinglings. I got tinglings. And then the Sun newspaper, I mentioned it in an interview, right, that I sort of, who my first crush was Shaken Stevens. They sort of said, who's your first crush? And then the Sun newspaper, fucking stirring. They call up Shaken Stevens and go, like, Matt Lucas fancies you. Like at the school playground, my mate fancies you. Like... I was already, I think, married.
Yeah.
Shaken Stevens was sort of 68 at the time. Poor Shaken Stevens goes, all right, that's very flattering. I put a little sort of quiet Welsh man, oh, that's very nice, thank you. I don't know what to say, really. And then, like, Then I went to a party and Shaken Stevens was there. And I was introduced to him and I was like, oh, hi, how are you doing? I'm no disrespect to Shaken Stevens. I don't fancy him now. Oh, okay. I fancied him in the Quiff. But yeah. The Sun newspaper, I think it was Gordon Smart, he was at the Sun, wrote, Matt Lucas ogled pictures of Shaken Stevens. And ogle was in bold. And I was 7 years old.
Yeah.
Sort of sexualised me at the age of seven. I was busy ogling already, apparently.
Yeah, that's weird.
I waited till I was nine.
I like Barry Manilow and Brian Connolly from Sweet.
Right.
And Nana Mouskouri.
Yeah, well, he's
those
hot.
Those are the first people.
Nana Mouskouri, lovely.
So I was confused.
Right.
About they would all look like ladies apart from Nana Mouskouri.
So why did you kiss the guy if you're just not gay?
Just to see what it was like.
Just
no, I think we're all a little bit somewhere in between the two.
So here's a question, right? You know when if you're kissing someone in a romantic context,
yeah.
It's sort of you might with one of your hands might just sort of slightly support their neck or slightly stroke their back or something tender.
Yeah.
Did you do anything tender during the kiss?
Can't remember. I mean, he was wanking me off at the time. I don't remember what I was doing. All I remember, he was really stubbly, and I didn't like the stubbliness.
Right, otherwise you'd be gay.
Yeah. If it'd been you, I'd have been absolutely fine.
You're in. This is where it started.
But, you know... Well, I was going to say, because, this is the thing I was going to talk to you about, but we haven't got time, but I'll talk to you about it. It was because, being in the 70s and at school, being gay was what all the kids would just... That was the biggest insult there was.
And 80s as well.
So just, you're gay.
Yeah, yeah.
And you talk about in the book and about, you know, your part in that with other boys, you know, joining in with that.
Yeah, I would tease other people and say they were gay.
But, you know, but it was... And so, my friend Steve Cheek, I said... He was one of my good friends. We were walking around the group and I said, I had a dream last night and I... did a poo in the dream, and Steve Cheek, and you know, in the dream, not in actuality, and Steve Cheek said he'd been reading Freud. He said, that means you're gay that you've done that. That's sort of Sigmund Freud, it means you're gay. And he generally meant it, that was his interpretation of whatever he'd read in Freud.
And I kind did of, you go, shut up, bum
no,
cheek?
No, then I kind of went, good, I should have done.
Thank you.
I kind of went, oh, maybe I am gay, because that was like scientific proof. So that was the kind of worrying, it sort of was worrying because it was meant to be the worst thing you could be, wasn't it? As you're talking about.
It was the biggest insult. But also, nobody asked you if you were gay. You were sort of informed that you were gay.
Yeah, that's true.
At school, weren't you? I think I found out I was gay when I truly knew was when I saw the poster for Richard Herring is Fat. That lovely Demi Moore, it was the Demi Moore, wasn't it? Yeah. That got me.
Well, Paul Sinha, the doctor comedian, turned comedian, I met him at a party in about 1999, 2000, and he said, oh, it's Richard Herring, I used to really fancy you. And I said, what happened? What went wrong?
I'm sure it still lingers
I'm sure it must be there. He's over me. I was a big gay icon.
You are, I'll tell you what, you are an inspiration to LGBTQ people everywhere.
Good, thank you.
You really are.
Thank you.
What you say is, this is what happens if you turn out straight. So really, I go with that.
It's a terrible thing.
Yeah.
Well, on that bombshell, ladies and gentlemen, give a massive round of applause, Matt Lucas!
Thank you.
You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Matt Lucas. Thank you to Pest for playing the music. Thank you to everyone at the Leicester Square Theatre and everyone at Go Past the Strike and Acast. You're all beautiful. You know who you are. Come on, guys. Don't embarrass me. I'm indebted to my producer, Ben Walker. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Go to rahalastapa.co.uk for more information about everything you have heard and seen. Bye.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening. Go to gofasterstripe.com for all your Richard Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.